You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 470.
I think people who have faults are a lot more interesting than people who are perfect. Spike Lee.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari.
Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T chart. Well, guys, today on the show, we have a pair of filmmakers who have done something that is almost impossible to do. And that's why I wanted to kind of talk to them and see how they did it. We have on the show today, James Lafferty and Stephen Coletti. And they are both actor, producers, and directors of the new Hulu show, Everything Is Doing Great. Now, James and Stephen did something that really hasn't been done before, which they actually shot an entire series first and then went and sold that series completely done to a major streamer. That's generally not the way it works. Generally, you would do a pilot, maybe, or you would pitch them the show and then they would pay for it and do it that way. But for whatever reason, they were able, I guess the timing and the product and everything, they were able to do the impossible and had Hulu purchase their show already produced. So they had complete creative control and they just did what they wanted to do. And they did it all on a shoestring budget, basically by crowdfunding and raising some capital in the private sector, which again, not a lot of money to do what they did. They really did this on an indie film style budget. So I really cannot wait to share with you all their secrets and how they did all this. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with James Lafferty and Stephen Coletti. I'd like to welcome to the show James Lafferty and Stephen Coletti. How are you guys doing?
Fantastic. Thanks for having
us. Well, man. Thanks for having us.
Oh, thank you for being on the show, man. I heard we have some friends in common, Ian and Esh Nelms, who were on my show a while ago promoting, or we're talking about their whole career, but at the time promoting Fat Man, which is obviously one of the best Christmas movies ever made. And my audience was going crazy for that episode because it is just hilarious. If anyone listening has not listened to, go find that episode on the back catalog because the boys were great. And then they reached out to me. They're like, hey, I got these guys who did this insane thing, were part of this project, and they pitched it to me. And I was like, well, I've never heard of that before. How the hell did these guys shoot an independent series that got picked up by a major streamer? Like, I know they picked up indie films because my film was picked up. My first film was picked up by them for, you know, license for a year back when they were doing that kind of stuff. But a show is unheard of. So we're going to get into the weeds about how you guys did that because I'm fascinated. I truly, really want to know how the hell that happened. But before we get into it, how did each of you get into the business? We'll start with you, Jimmy.
Yeah, so I started really young. I started doing extra work actually when I was about 6 years old. My my mom would bring my brother and I in from Riverside County to LA just to get onto sets, just to sort of expand our world a little bit. We didn't really know, you know, at a young age what we wanted to be. You know, obviously we didn't, you know, we weren't like theater kids or stage kids or anything like that. It was really just for our mom to, you know, help us understand that the world was bigger than that small town that we came from. And we just fell in love with it, of course. I mean, you can't really take a kid to a film set and play around with other kids and get to experience that atmosphere and have them not catch the bug. Hmm. And sure enough, we did. And so from about 10 years old on, I started auditioning. And from there, it was just like a steady progression of, you know, booking my first Mervyn's commercial at 12 to, you know, getting a guest spot on, you know, Picket Fences or something like that. And then you know, just continuing on from there, to reoccurring roles. And, I basically, by the time I was a senior in high school, I had, booked, this little, WB teen drama called One Tree Hill, which ended up becoming, sort of a hit, I guess. It at least ran for a very long time, until about, 2011. That sort of takes us up to, you know, I guess when I was an adult, right? You know, that's sort of how that was my way in, really.
Right. How about you, Stephen?
Yeah, I was a little more unconventional. I kind of first started working the business in about 2004, working with MTV. I started out doing a reality show with them, completely victim of circumstance, out of nowhere did this show land in my community and drop in my lap. But I was interested in hosting and wanted to get in entertainment. And so, in fact, one thing I want to do was to be a VJ, you know, watching Carson Daly growing up and doing that gig. I thought that was a pretty cool thing and wanted to pursue that. So I looked at MTV as like, well, all right, I feel like these people can get me in over there. So wound up doing this show called Laguna Beach for a season, two seasons. And then I started hosting for MTV, and then I did a little bit of acting growing up, you know, just in school and stuff, and enjoyed it. But didn't think it was going to be something I'd take seriously. And the more I kind of got into hosting, wasn't so excited about it. Found acting interesting, wanted to study it, and did. And so as I was hosting for MTV, I, you know, was working on acting and studying and. From there, I booked my first film, something called, it wound up being Havoc 2. It wasn't supposed to be the sequel originally, but that's what Hootay New Line, I think it was. That's what they wound up selling it as, called Normal Adolescent Behavior. And in that film, actually worked with a girl named Hillary Burton, who worked on One Tree Hill. And I wound up auditioning for One Tree Hill and getting a part there. And then it was kind of set on working on the show with James for about 5 or 6 years.
So you guys are coming at this whole thing very unconventionally because you're coming from the acting side. So you guys were on a hit show for a good amount of time. You've been on, obviously you guys have been on sets a lot throughout your careers, up to this point. And then what made you guys get together and say, you know, we're going to take the power in our own hands and build our own content and try to sell that own? So you essentially stop asking permission to do what you love to do and start creating those opportunities for yourselves. Very, very Ben and Matt, Goodwill Hunting style, in that way. So what made you as actors decide to, like, you know, is there something that caused you to do it? Or is there something that you tickled your fancy? Or did you just like, you know what, we really need to kind of get our own stuff going?
Yeah, I think it was a mixture of things, as it always is, I guess. You know, it has a little something to do with, you know, coming off of a TV show and thinking things are going to be easy and actually not being that easy. It's, you know, getting to a certain point in your life as an actor, or I guess as a professional in this business, where you realize that things are cyclical. Like, you're going to have, you're going to have times that are, you know, really good for a while. You're going to have a great cycle, and then you're going to have a really dry cycle, and then you're going to, it's going to come back. It's a sort of pendulum swing situation. And you start to realize that at I guess around, for us, it was around that 25, 26, 27 age when One Tree Hill was ending. Right. But then also, you know, I don't think you can be on a show for that long and not learn something. I mean, you'd really have to not be.
You have to be pretty dense. You have to be pretty dense at that point.
Yeah, sink in. And I think, you know, we were always paying very close attention because we always knew that behind the camera was where we would want to be eventually. We knew that we would want to tell stories. You know, for me, a big part of it was being able to step behind the camera and direct on One Tree Hill. And then I know, you know, Steven can speak to, you know, the fact that he was producing coming out of One Tree Hill and stuff. But, you know, that's sort of where I was coming from, is like, I know I want to tell stories, but, you know, and I know I'm going to want to write, right? So I'm writing scripts, and these scripts are like high concept and very expensive. And this is obviously, as you know, and your audience will know, these ideas are very hard to get made. So at a certain point for me, it was like, okay, what can I make, that can, be made, you know, what can we make that can be made for a reasonable budget, and that we can actually shoot, so that we can prove to people that we can tell stories and hopefully take that next step as storytellers, not just people who are, you know, auditioning for jobs.
How about you, Steven?
Well, I think I feel like it was always somewhere. It was something in the back of my mind, knowing that, you know, in this industry, especially just with the technology these days, what it affords you, you better be able to figure out stuff on your own. Cause, you know, I know that where I stand in this industry, and I was not, you know, God's gift to the entertainment industry as an actor. And so I knew to do certain things that I wanted to do, you know, you're going to have to create those opportunities for yourself. And, so I you know, it's just kind of been a steady, evolution of, you know, trying different things, you know, realizing I had all my eggs in the acting basket when I was in my 20s, and realizing that the opportunities that were coming to me were kind of out of my control. You know, you go audition for things, and some things you really, really want, and it's almost like the more you want something, the more you wind up not getting it. And then a job that you're like, eh, I really don't care if I get this job. And it's like, hey, you booked it. You know, I gotta go take it because I need a job. So I think that, you know, to really, as I got a little bit older, and a little more, a little more edgy about the business, and realize, all right, if you know what I want to do, I'm going to have to, you know, take the bull by the horns and try to figure out how to do it on my own. Cause you know, it's not going to all just line up with landing the perfect audition at the best time and booking it. And then off you go, you know, it's just not, that does not happen every day or, you know, likely at all. You know, I think from there, you know, it's been an evolution of certain projects that, you know, haven't gone very far, and just, you know, whether it be a little bit of writing, a little bit of producing, but, you know, kind of learning something from each thing. And then, you know, with this one, with Everyone Is Doing Great, kind of felt like all the pieces started to, you know, fall into place where, okay, it could take, you know, what I've learned up to this point in trying to get stuff made and go out there. Also to say, you know, partner up with somebody, you know, realize that I can't do stuff, you know, on my own, and you know, you got to get good people around you to help you, you know, fill in your weaknesses mm-hmm. and get, you know, get things made.
So how did you guys come up with Everyone Is Doing Great?
Yeah, it was sort of out of necessity, I guess. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we had lived enough life coming out of One Tree Hill to realize that we had lived a pretty absurd life in our 20s. And to have that amount of success at such a young age is completely, it's absurd. It's, mm-hmm. it's insane what happened. And we were insanely fortunate. And then to have, you know, some years that weren't so successful, you know, to really humble you and to make you look back and go, okay, I see a sort of like arc forming here where, you know, we had a late coming of age, you know, and we had a late coming of age in this really crazy industry where hilarious things are happening all around us. And there's, you know, extraordinary things happening all around us that really make for great comedy. You know, and, you know, we've never felt sorry for ourselves throughout this whole process of, you know, auditioning and rejection and all of this stuff. Like, I think, you know, we've always found the narrative that it's, you know, a really tough thing to do a little bit tiresome, because it's what we chose to do, right? Like, nobody's going to feel sorry for you because you just keep coming back for more, and you know you're always going to come back for more. So really, for us, the catharsis in all this was just to laugh at it, to get together and to share our stories and to be like, you're never going to believe what happened at this audition today. Like, you're never going to believe what I saw at this party or this person that I met, or and just laugh at these things. And, you know, this is something that we really wanted to bring to a show that lined up with our comedic sensibilities, right? Like, we knew that we wanted to make a show that was up to the standards of the shows that we love to watch. Mm-hmm. We love shows like Fleabag, you know, Catastrophe. We love this, The Trip with Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon. Like, we love that show on HBO, Dahl and M, things that are feel really naturalistic and feel really dry, and mind the humor out of a lot of like awkward and cringy moments instead of punchlines. And we just felt like we were like living in this world where all of a sudden we could see this happening around us. We were sort of observing it. And so we decided to sort of, I guess, take that and try to create some characters that we could map onto these things, onto this world and into these situations, and create a story around it that would also line up with our storytelling sensibilities, which is really, we gravitate to stories about, you know, friends, families, and, you know, families basically that are full of people that are just there. They probably shouldn't be friends, but they have this shared experience, or they have this shared past, where they're sort of forced to continue to deal with each other. Mm-hmm. And whether or not they stick together is based on whether or not they love each other, right? Like, those are the stories that we're onto. So it was just all these things, a sort of confluence of things that came together to, at this time, to make us realize that we might have, you know, a story to tell here through Everyone's Doing Great.
Now, Stephen, did your agents and managers and your friends around you say, you guys are absolutely nuts? This is not going to work. No one's ever, you know, done an independent show before and sold it to anything major before. I mean, did that happen?
You know, I got kind of the status quo from the reps, where it was like, oh, that's really nice. Oh, that's sweet. You know, they're like, okay.
And you go do your little.
You're still going to be auditioning, right? Like, we should still be sending you stuff. And I'm like, yeah, no, of course. Please do. They're like, okay, all right, just making sure. But, you know, I think that they hear that, and the expectation on their end is like, oh, man, if I had a nickel for every time I heard a client talk about something that they're making on their own and never seeing the light of day. And even myself, they'd probably have a few nickels for me, because I definitely have done it before.
Right.
As, you know, try to shake them down to help you, you know, get some traction on a script, or like get something, you know, get them to read something that you wrote. So there, you know, there was that kind of like, you know, yeah, they're just playing along. But I think at Friends, it was, you know, we had some good support from friends that were rooting us on. Like, you know, I think people in the industry were like, fuck yeah, man, like, go do it, you know? And I think that it also, you know, with the community of people that got around our show when we were crowdfunding, I mean, that really helped lift us up and continue, have us, you know, continue to move forward on it, was that, you know, people were on board and excited. They heard about the concept. They would just be looking at a log line and being like, you know what, that seems interesting. I'd be into that. And they're like, yeah, like, I want to contribute to the show. Go on and do it. So I think it was, you know, for the most part, it was positive feedback, and to have like our communities of family and friends saying, you know, go for it, is really cool, and definitely helped propel us to the finish line.
So I find it fascinating when you said that the agents played along, because I actually, you know, earlier in my career, I had a full films and I got a star attached, and it was she'd done TV and she had done a few movies and things like that. And we go in, and what you're saying is exactly what the agents would do. They came in, they did the show, they sat around the conference table and like, okay, so, you know, oh yeah, we can go out to this person, and yeah, we might know this person, to try to kind of play along. And I was so green. I'm like, oh my God, we're going to get this movie made. This is amazing. And then, you know, nothing ever panned out, but they needed to play along to keep the client happy. So I'm so like, I didn't know that was a thing. And when you just said it, I'm like, that makes all the sense in the world, because I've been in that room when we're like, oh yeah, because she's the producer on this and she wants to put this all together. I was like, no wonder nothing ever came of it, you know?
Of course, you know, it's like they know the road, and
It's tough.
I get it. If they don't have the time for that, and they're like, look, this is a bottom line game I'm here with my clients for. Like, you know, like I know if this person's getting started on a project, like this film is not going to be made next month, in 6 months. And wow, if they make it in a year, that's incredible. So they're like, I don't have time for something that's 2 years out. You know what I mean? Like
we need to get paid now. I need my 10%. I need my 10%.
Yeah.
So
I'm staring at 10% in 2024.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Good luck, buddy.
Good luck. Yeah, exactly. Good luck to you, my friend. But you're still going to go out. We can still send you out, right? We can still send you out. Yeah. I love that, because they're like, we still need to make our money off of you right now. So it's fascinating.
Be supportive 100%.
Oh yeah, yeah.
That's supportive. Just means like, you know, saying like, yeah, sure, we'll help.
I'll call Will Smith.
And then we'll step in later.
Yeah, if you bring in $5 million, we can get the rest.
We are game. Yeah,
of course.
Yeah, you bring $5 million and Will Smith to the table, we can get you the rest of it. Yeah. No problem. Yeah. that's the way the game is played. So all right, so guys, how did you put this, is this self-financed? I mean, because it doesn't look like it's like a, you know, it's not Game of Thrones for sure. So I'm assuming the budget was, you know, indie, but how did you guys raise the budget?
Yeah, well, it was sort of a tiered process, sort of just like the entire process was. You know, we didn't know that we were going to shoot our entire season independently. We started off with a pilot, and the pilot was self-financed. And very naively, we thought that we would execute this pilot, and
the money would just come in.
We would sell it, and then somebody would be like, "Oh yeah, we want this to be a, you know, Hulu original or whatever." Yeah, that didn't happen. That didn't happen for a lot of reasons. You know, first of all, I think the pilot that we made was a pilot that we wanted to make, and we were really, really proud of it. But it was 2017, you know, a lot of the streamers that exist now didn't even exist back then. And a lot of the, you know, bigger ones now were just sort of booting up, and, you know, their different departments and sort of really defining what kind of things they wanted to do. And we just didn't anticipate the challenges of shopping around an independent TV show. We didn't realize just how kind of, I guess, unprecedented it was.
Insane.
It was just not something that happened. There was no template for selling it. Right. Further than that, we didn't know, that we even needed a sales agent, really. We didn't know the sales agent game, right? We were having our talent reps reach out to development people at these companies, and seeing if, like, you know, they would get, you know, if they could push the ball forward. We weren't considering the acquisitions departments and things like that. You know, we'll talk about this later about, you know, we didn't actually know how sort of nebulous that world was as well, and how many gatekeepers that there were and how relationship based it is. So we just didn't have any of these relationships or any of these connections. So once we realized we weren't going to sell the pilot, and that if we were going to produce the rest of the season, episodes 2 through 8, we were going to have to do it independently. We had always considered the crowdfunding route. But we didn't know for sure if we wanted to take that plunge. It was really our last sort of final option, because we had heard that it's going to be the hardest thing you ever do.
Yes, I've done it. It's
so
horrible.
And you know, the Nelms brothers, who you had on in the past, like they did it as well. And I watched them do it. And I watched them break their backs for the money that they made for Post on their first movie, or one of their first movies. And, you know, they were encouraging us to do this as well. Like, the Gnomes Brothers had our backs on the crowdfunding front. They were like, you should do this because it's going to help you retain creative control. Whatever money you can raise of your budget, it's going to help you maintain that leverage and that control over the project for its life. I guess, you know, once we had exhausted all options, we took that plunge, that crowdfunding plunge. Crowdfunded for how many days, Stephen? 45 days?
At least 45. No, June, July, and then we extended a little bit into August. So it wound up being up to about 3 months.
And what platform did you guys use? Kickstarter, Indiegogo?
Indiegogo.
Great. And how much did you guys raise?
We wound up raising about 270K. And
that's,
then after,
that's awesome.
Yeah, after fees and we had to take some money for the perks and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. We were able to use about at least 210, 215 into our budget. And then we had to bridge the gap a little bit to get to where we could, you know, still have enough to finish the season.
That's amazing. But that's a success, man. Like, you pulling over $250,000 on a platform for a television or a streaming series. That's a pretty good goal. I guess you tapped into a lot of your fans and things like that to help with that, I'm assuming.
Yeah. No, I know. For sure. To have people, you know, contribute for a show they haven't seen before. You know, this was not the reunion or the sequel of something. So, people were having to take a leap of faith for us. I think we struggled a little bit out the gate trying to get people on board for this. But it was, you know, ultimately it was that community behind, One Tree Hill that, you know, got involved and wanted to see us, you know, where we wanted to support us in whatever our next venture was, because they knew that maybe, you know, the reunion wasn't going to be happening anytime soon. So, incredible community of fans there, been very loyal, and we're very grateful for that, because without them, this doesn't happen. And it ultimately was, you know, about 2 weeks in, we're like, we need some sort of kick, you know, we really need something to boost the finances there, or at least, you know, the money coming in for the Indiegogo project. And we came up with the idea of doing some live watches where we would invite some cast members from the show, from our old show, One Tree Hill, and watch an episode. And, it offered us a great opportunity for us to, you know, see some of our cast members that we hadn't seen for a while, and kind of to fill a little bit of that want for, you know, what the fans are looking for is they're trying to hear the news on whether or not the show's going to have a reunion or whatnot. It's like, well, they just want to see some of these people back together. And, to get, you know, four or five of us sitting in a room chatting about the show, it was, an experience that the fans really enjoyed. And they came back, you know, four or five times as we did a few of them. And it wound up just being, you know, the most lucrative thing for us in our project. And raising that.
Yeah. I mean, you leverage what you have. So, you know, if you've got a fan base, and I'm assuming, how did you get to that fan base? I mean, did you just hit the Facebook groups? I mean, I don't think you have an email list with a bunch of One Tree Hill fans. So like, how did you reach out to these communities and get them to watch and to contribute?
Yeah. Our followings on social media were a huge part of it. Pretty much everybody that follows me is a One Tree Hill fan, unless they're my mom or my friend. That was really important, is being able to connect with people through social media. That was what brought in, you know, our first wave of people. But I think another really important thing was that we were able to show these people that this first wave of people that we have a product that you're going to like, right? Because the challenge with an arts project is that you can't really show them the content of the arts project, right? You can't really like have virtual screenings for people of the movie you're trying to make. Fortunately, we were making a TV show and we had shot a pilot, and we were able to take this pilot around to some festivals that were really, really great. Like ATX Festival is a television festival in Austin that showcases all kinds of television. They showcase a few independent pilots every year. They chose us for one of theirs. Series Fest is an all independent television festival that they hold in Denver, Colorado. At the time, New York Television Festival was one. There was a bunch of different festivals that we were able to hit, and we were able to invite fans out, you know, people that knew about us from One Tree Hill, invite them to these screenings, talk to them after these screenings, meet them after these screenings, and get their, first of all, creatively get their feedback, right? See if the show was actually funny to them. But then also they were able to see the first episode of the show and then, you know, tell other people on our Instagram feeds or on our Twitter feeds or, you know, on the message board on Indiegogo, like, yes, this is a good show. You will like this show. You know, there's something here. So I think that was a huge, huge asset to us, being able to take out that sort of, you know, if this wasn't a TV show, you'd call it like a proof of concept, right? Mm-hmm, but it was a TV show, it was a pilot. And it just the timing of that, taking out for those festivals, we in hindsight, we realized just how incredibly, valuable that was for us.
And how many days did you shoot? How many total days? I mean, assuming you just sat and just shot it all out in a row, right? So how many days did you shoot 8 episodes? And did each episode's what, 30 minutes? Less than that?
Approximately 30. Yeah. We got anywhere from 25 to 37 minutes. Mm-hmm. So thankful for the streaming services to be flexible on those run times.
Exactly.
So we didn't have to kill as many babies as we might expected. Yeah, we wound up shooting over the course of about 35 days, 8 episodes.
That's a lot.
And yeah, obviously block shooting everything, getting locations wrapped up, and was you know, key. Michelle Lang, who
that was 7 episodes, right, that we shot, because we had already shot the pilot the year before, and then we shot 7 episodes, the 7 additional episodes over that 35 day period the year after.
Minus 1 is 7. That is confirmed. This is why we make a great team. Michelle Lang, who works with the Nelms brothers, she's married to Ian there. She, you know, was so clutch in getting our schedule all dialed up and making sure that, you know, we're maximizing our locations. And it was fluid too. That schedule was changing constantly. I mean, she did a good job of mapping it out in the beginning, and we kind of had an idea of where we were going to be for those next 35 days from the jump, of course. But, you know, she was always kind of looking to adjust it. Where can we save a buck? And, you know, having somebody like that on our team, just, you know, thinking about things that we are not even anywhere on this in the same universe of thinking about with that scheduling and how we can save some money, because especially when we're doing our shoestring budget, was key. So it was hectic, but we got it done. And, you know, Michelle Lang was a big part of that.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
So you guys, you guys have been on sets pretty much almost all your life at this point. You were like really were on sets for a long time, and you've directed a few episodes here and there. How much did that play in the success of what you guys were doing? I mean, because obviously you knew what a professional quote unquote set was, but you knew that One Tree Hill set is definitely not going to be all the bells and whistles that you're going to be using on this show. So how was that transition? Because, mm-hmm. you know, you're used to being on – I've been on network sets. They're nice. They're plush. The crafty is fantastic. Lunch is, you know, lobster. You know, it's really a nice scenario depending on the budget of the show. But generally speaking, network shows are really nice. So how was that transition from – hey, I need something. Oh, we have a department for that too. We need something. Figure it out.
Yeah, I think it's a really good question, because I think there are things that we learned, you know, from being on larger sets that helped us, and there were also things that totally blindsided us as well, right? You know, there was I think the general concept of time management really sinks in when you work in television, you know, on whatever budget you're working on. Like, you know, working on whatever network TV show, you're still trying to shoot an ungodly amount of pages a day. No matter what, there's not enough time. You never have enough days to get the show, to get the episode that you want to shoot. And as an actor, you sit around and you just watch people like run around like their hair's on fire, trying to make this impossible thing possible. So, and you learn about time management really well, because you're always watching your clock, right? And so I think that's one thing that we were able to carry into everyone is doing great is clock management, right? Is that time management, is making sure that, you know, we have contingency plans, that we have this space in our schedule to shoot things that we might have missed, or that we're able to adapt. If, you know, we didn't get this one thing at this location, what other location can we put it at? We had seen enough of this sort of sleight of hand be played, you know, throughout our careers to be able to employ it ourselves, and obviously with the help of our producing team. But then also there's nothing that can compare you to, you know, or that can prepare you for the first week of our shooting in Steven's actual apartment. And, you know, the fact that there's going to be 35 crew in a 2-bedroom apartment, you know, wearing their work boots. And
did you get permission or were you gorilla? Oh, you did get permission. You didn't gorilla.
Yeah, but you know, we
you stretched
we got
it.
Permission for a couple of people, you know, just for like 2 days, not necessarily. We won't say how many people were there. And we won't say for how many days, but it didn't really work out to that, what I had quoted.
I mean, and you know, you got to like hand it to Steven, who is, you know, this is his apartment. He's producing, writing the show. He's directing one of the episodes that we're shooting at that location. And he's got to be thinking about all these different things. And he's also thinking about the fact that, like, this person today didn't wear soft-soled shoes.
Yep.
So, like, we might get kicked out. You know what I mean? Or he's worried about, you know, getting Starbucks gift cards to all of his neighbors and making sure that they got them so that we've got, you know, we're in the good graces of the building. You know, it's not a completely conducive mindset to creativity. And nothing, you know, can really prepare you for that. Nothing in our experiences on
TV I got shows PTSD ever right now. That. Seriously,
you're like you're starting to I can see the twitching. I can see the twitching happening.
I don't know how we got through those days. But yeah, I mean, I got sick in the middle of it as well.
Oh yeah. And,
anytime an Apple box was just scraping across the floor, I mentally murdered that individual and then carried on with my scene.
I'll tell you what, man, like I've shot so much in my own places during my career, like at my own house, like my first like $50,000 I spent on my commercial demo reel back when I was doing commercials, which I shot on 35 and all that. I did it in my house. I had like two full shoots in my house, like doing different areas. Like in my living room, I'd set up a set and I like, cause I had to. And that exact thing, someone like a grip would just drag something along and you're just like trying to direct it. And then you have the money. So this is basically the only thing that you did that I didn't do is I didn't act in it. Thank God. So I'm doing everything else, but I feel you, man. Like you that Apple box gets dragged. Oh God. Oh,
I know.
Geez.
I know. We had,
it's brutal.
And I had this deck that was great. Cause you know, people can go have lunch out there and we can store gear out there. But you know, we fired up breakfast there at like 6:15 in the morning. Oh my God. How did we get away with it?
Starbucks cards go a long way.
Really
yeah.
Did.
Yeah. Thankfully, you know, there was some supportive people, some supportive neighbors, but then there wasn't some supportive neighbors. And we did get a noise complaint like on the first day. You know, there was the manager who I'd spoke to hadn't talked to somebody else. And so they showed up and they were like, what are you doing? And I was like, you know, I talked to blah, blah, blah. They're like, oh, okay. All right. Right on. But at first I thought, you know, they had come to basically shut us down. So yeah, man, it's, thank God that was,
can you see how much stress this guy,
he's stressed out. He is stressing out. It's over, bro. Bro, it's over. It's over. It's okay.
It honestly felt like a mistake because after all of this buildup to get to this point of wanting to shoot the show and it's our own and we're so excited and we got our first couple days of shooting. And then all of a sudden it's just back to back days, like in my apartment, with one thing after another. And I couldn't, you know, once we got to the finish line and we were like halfway through that last day there. And I'm like, okay, we got it now. I know we're going to get through this location. The shoot started for me, but I couldn't tell you what happened on any of the scenes in my character's apartment because, my brain was just ping ponging off the walls.
And that's the thing. I mean, for filmmakers listening now, man, until you're in the weeds, or as they used to say, like when you're in war, when you're in the shit, you really, really feel it because, man, it's a thousand things going on at the same time. You've got money dealing with, you've got your you're acting, which is insanity to me. Like I can't even begin to try to think about acting in a scene while doing all this stuff. It's brutal, man. But I think this is a comment that no one's ever, this is a sentence that's never been uttered in Hollywood. All I have is too much time and too much money to make this project. Like that, that's never been uttered in Hollywood since the days of fucking Edison. Like, no one has ever said that.
Absolutely not.
You know, it's insane. So
you got another week. You sure you don't want to use it?
Yeah.
I mean,
no, I'm good.
Do you want another month? I mean, we could just do another month if you want. Like, never, you never hear that. It's insane. I mean,
to Panama and get that shot on the beach. You don't want it?
Okay. You don't want it? That's fine. We'll just green screen it. That's fine. Sure. Yeah, and I can imagine the culture shock for you guys as being, you know, regular actors on a hit show and never having to think about any of that. Like, even when you were directing on the show, you still never had to think about that. You were just directing a show and it's all your family and friends are around, you know, you've been with these people forever. You don't think about all that other stuff, really. I mean, you time management, yeah, but when everything's on your shoulders, I gotta believe that the culture shock must have been, at what moment did that hit you guys? Like, was it day one when you said, on day one on the pilot, even, like, did you just go, oh, we're not in Kansas anymore? Like, when was that? I mean, I'm sure someone told you. And it's like having kids. Someone could tell you you're going to have kids, but and oh, it's going to be bad. You're going to lose sleep. Until you have a kid, you have no idea. It's like right in your face. So when was that moment for you guys?
I think for me, it was when we were at Steven's apartment. And I don't know. This is probably the first time we've ever told this story. We might get crucified by our producers, but I just think it's too interesting. You know, we had when we started shooting, we had about 2/3 of our budget, and we had a contingency plan in place. Like, we were starting at Steven's apartment. We're going to shoot all this contained stuff. We knew that we could shoot a version of our season for 2/3 of the budget, right? We would just have to change a lot once we left Steven's apartment. And we were still waiting to see if a financier was going to come on to cover that final third. And we were getting to the point, I was probably like 4 or 5 days in, when it was really like a breaking point. And Michelle Lang had to come to set and like sit me and Steven down and sit Ian Anesh down and Johnny Durango, our other executive producer. And, you know, the rest of the crew setting up a shot over at Steven's apartment. And we are like down the hall and sort of around the corner in like a little outdoor lounge. We can see across the gap to Steven's apartment. And it was nighttime. And Michelle's walking us through the fact that we might not get this money and that it could change a lot, but that everything's going to be okay. And I remember just having like a bit of like an out of body experience where I just sort of went numb, and I just sort of left. Like, I was sort of seeing the world from behind my eyes. And I was like, oh, this is it. This is what they talk about.
I'm dying.
When it all means too much and it's all on you. And, something either really, really, miraculous is going to happen, or this is going to be a horror story. You know what I mean? It's like, this is the moment that it hinges on. And thankfully something miraculous happened in that particular scenario. But that was a real, that was a real moment for me.
It was like you guys had a coming to Jesus conversation, like come to Jesus conversations, basically. They sat you down, like, it's like, this guy's, look, and I've had, by the way, I've had those conversations with my first AD on projects or my UPM on early projects. They're like, look, man, I know you've got 752 shots you want to do in 4 hours. I understand that. But this is the reality. You got 4 shots. Let's do this.
Yep.
So you were going to say, Steve?
I was just going to say, I think in I feel like, you know, James and I, we've had this like, you know, go get them attitude. So it was like, there's nothing that we can't handle. Like, we'll figure it out. You know, we'll figure out how we'll do this. Like, we're just not going to take no for an answer, blah, blah, blah. Like, just learn on the fly. That's why I like working with James. Like, he's resourceful. He gets it. He just shuts up and does the work, you know? And, you know, there was definitely times where like, oh, you know what? It's not necessarily we've taken on too much. It's like, you just can't do this. Like, this isn't, there are people that have gone to school for this or have trained to do this for a while. And some of the tasks, like, we just took for granted. Like, for example, locations. Like, I was doing locations for a while. And then we got closer to shooting. And it was like, all right, there's still a lot of locations that need to be actually locked. And then it was like, well, those are kind of in the second half, so we'll start shooting. And now we're shooting, and there's some locations in the back half that we're still trying to lock. And we're trying to negotiate. Like, at every single location, it was not taking their, you know, their first offer, letting them know, like telling them the story, you know, we're crowdfunded, we're shoestring budget over here. So like, please, like, you know, what can you do to help us out? And it just, there was, you know, you're just juggling those. And we actually had in the middle of the shoot to bring somebody on and say, okay, this person's going to just handle locations. Like, stop worrying about it. See if you tried, you know, you got some good stuff, but like, it's starting to, you know, it distract you from other things. So,
You can't be driving from Northridge down to Downey every day. We're putting the finishing touches on the script. It's just not, like,
And that's one of the biggest mistakes first time filmmakers in the indie space do, is they'd like, oh, I can do all of this. Oh, I could do this. I could do that. And they take so much on that you get nothing done. You have to bring people, and you have to have help in one way, shape, or form. And sometimes it's educated help. Sometimes it's uneducated help. Like, you know, you get your brother, your buddy who wants to be in the business. Like, look, do location scouts. Sometimes it works out great. Sometimes not so much.
Yeah. You know, I think the line is blurred these days as well with, you know, what you can learn and what you can't execute, right? Mm-hmm. Like you mm-hmm. can learn a lot, like, and this has been a blessing for us. You know, the fact that technology has come so far, the fact that our access to information is just so exponentially better than it was even 10 years ago. You know, but it also gives you this false sense of security. It gives you this, you know, false sense of capability, really, I think. You know, we did learn to do a lot. And we were, especially in post-production, right? Once we got into the editing process, we were able to save ourselves a lot of coin just by doing things ourselves and learning to do things by ourselves. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we had to recognize where we had to draw the line. We're like, you know, okay, we can keep banging our heads against a wall with this thing that we just learned to do on YouTube 3 days ago, or we can sort of, you know, reach a point where we realize, oh, this is what they pay people big bucks for. Okay, let's go find somebody who knows what they're doing, right? Before we, you know, carve up our project more than we need to here, or, you know, do something, you know, make some sort of fatal mistake, right?
So you guys didn't shoot your own movie. You weren't the DPs as well.
we did not Soderbergh it. No,
you didn't. Soderbergh. Dude, I found out. I honestly, within like a couple years ago, I found out that Soderbergh was his own DP, and he'd always been his own DP. I had no idea because he changes his name on the credits.
Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Then you go back, you're like, he did Ocean's 11 and Che and. I mean, Aaron Brockovich and all, like he was the
wild.
It's what you start thinking about it. And you're like, and he was the writer and he was like, he's a freak of nature. He's like an absolute freak of nature to do all of that.
Yeah.
Very few guys can do that. And trust me, my first feature, I was the DP on, and mind you, I was already 20 years in and I've been a colorist for 10 years. So I'm like, you know what? Let me just get it down the line. If I just did it down the middle. Expose it. I'll fix it in post, which is exactly what I did. But after that, I was like, never again. Never, ever, ever again. Man. It's too much, man. It's too much. It takes a special brain to do all of that stuff.
You know what?
Good.
I was just gonna say another thing we learned like real quick was I think it was important to take being able to understand like a pulse of your set. I felt like I recognized as I'm sitting around on a set waiting for, you know, to act on certain just the, you know, how quickly like a dynamic can change. It's almost like people are, and especially in these long days, like people can get, you know, they get edgy and naturally. I totally understand it. And so it doesn't take much to set people off. And so to kind of, you know, be a little more aware of, you know, the treatment of people, especially for us when, you know, there's no room to go anywhere. We were crammed in an apartment or we're crammed in whatever location, you know, all on top of each other that, you know, to try to, you know, respect people for the jobs that they're doing, give the attaboys and you know, also, I guess, still try to provide some decent food because, you know, our crew, like they, you know, we had them, there's no comfort for them whatsoever. And they're working completely full days. And, you know, I think Michelle Lang was key in saying, well, we're going to pay for a decent caterer. You know, we got to get them fed well. You know, just trying to, I don't know, just check in with crew and have like, you know, you create a cordial relationship with everybody. And I think that also helps at the end of the day when, you know, the going gets tough and people either want to get the F out of there, which I understand, or just so sick of like this lack, like we're missing a couple resources and you're having to wear an extra hat that you're not necessarily getting paid for, but like, you know what, they're going to step up because they believe in the people that are running this project. I think that helped us a lot. And, you know, we also had a lot of young filmmakers, people that are just getting started in the business. And that was really crucial because while they're not getting paid, you know, big money, they're ready to hustle, you know, they're ready to, you know, to be on a set and make a film project, you know? So, that was, you know, something that was also very vital to, you know, fill in the blanks of not having a comfortable set that you would get on a major network.
Yeah.
Did you
and
guys?
That's something that we learned.
No, go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to say, that's something that we learned from the Nelms brothers as well. Being on sets with the Nelms brothers, I learned very early on with them that like the reason that their sets are so amazing and people are so happy is because, they realize that they're not being asked to do anything that the directors wouldn't do themselves or don't have the utmost respect for. Right. Like, these are guys that, these are not directors that go to the director's trailer in between setups and do whatever the hell they want to do in there. Like, these are guys who are there on set every single moment. They love the process. They truly love being there. And that is contagious. And that's what gets people through those long days and those long nights, is knowing that the person at the top still really cares about this and really cares about, you know, really wants everybody else to care. And is willing to put in the work just like they are. I mean, we learned that from them very early on, and just, we tried to be those guys on set every day.
Now, did you guys happen to feed your crew spinning wheels of death? Do you know what those are?
What is that?
This is the best stuff ever comes from old DPs. So a buddy of mine who's he's been in the business 40, 50 years, and he was DPing something I was directing, and it was a low budget situation. And we talked about lunch, and I said, hey, do you guys, you know, maybe we should just get some pizza. He's like, do not bring out spinning wheels of death. Do not bring out, he goes, that's what they're called, because it just drags the crew, cheese and bread, and it just slows everyone down. He goes, don't do it. And he also always used to say, every time he couldn't get something the way he wanted to, he's like, I'm surrounded by assassins. Everywhere I look, surrounded by assassins. And I use that line constantly on a set, like, surrounded by assassins, god damn it. But did you do the pizza thing at one point?
We actually didn't do pizza.
Good. That's a good producer. Good producer.
Shout out. Was it Spartan Catering, James?
Spartan Brothers. Yeah.
They were solid. They had good food we tried to make really sure. Yeah. You know, have the other options for people with allergies or whatever, and just made sure we're on top of that. Or you know, there was a couple days where they might have forgotten, or maybe those first days, you know, working through the kinks that there weren't enough of those meals. It was like, let's go, you know, let's get this fixed right now, you know. And other than that, we kept them well caffeinated, that's for sure. this started, well, myself, but our DP was a caffeine fiend. And so we just made sure we got the Starbucks runs and the coffee going. And, you know, thankfully it was a small enough crew that we're like, all right. And this is something that James and I would just handle. We're like, you know what, just take our card and go. Let's get everyone, whoever wants something from Starbucks or
just
whatever.
Just go. It's the cheapest investment you can make in this film. I'll tell you a quick story. I come from Miami originally. So in Miami, on sets, there's a little old Cuban man. He's hired. It's always a little old Cuban man who walks around about 2 to 3 times a day with a tray full of these little thimbles of coffee called cotaditos, which is Cuban coffee. Little, they're like this big, and you look like that can't do anything. And I always used to love, I'm Cuban, so I was raised with this stuff. So I see, you know, people who are not used to Cuban coffee, like, oh, there's just a few of them. That's just so little. And they would chug like 4 or 5 of them at once. And within 15 minutes, they're just freaking out. And I'm like, all the people who are used to that coffee, like, look, let's watch. Let's see what happens to that actor. And you just see him just start freaking out, like trying to do a scene. So Cuban coffee, if you can ever
manage that early.
I love that. That sounds efficient.
there's a little way he does it with the sugar, and he makes it all foam up. It's an artistry thing, and they're little thimbles, man. Not even shot glass, like thimbles. That's how powerful and dense the Cuban coffee is. The way he makes it,
yeah. Awesome. The Starbucks runs, and it is, I think, Starbucks. You know, there's sure people that will shit on the coffee naturally because it's not that great, but there's still a lot of people that are like, oh my god, it's a dessert to them, right?
A couple people.
So you get that coffee run dialed up for right after lunch, and it's a little gift. That gift goes a long way.
Mm-hmm.
Those anytime that the crew was feeling down, it was like, all right, let's on the double with the Starbucks runs, and then when someone would show up with them, you know, everyone perked up, and it
was as much for us as it was for anybody else too. I mean, we needed it.
You gotta keep the ball rolling. I mean, look, if you don't have money to pay them their normal day rates, at minimum feed them well and get them coffee.
Yes,
feed them well and get them coffee. That's, I mean, you could you could pay them nothing, feed them well.
Yes,
and that's at minimum you have to do, and that's going to be the best investment you can have in your projects, without question. Sorry, so you finally get this whole thing together, guys. It's finished, it's done. You guys are feeling good about it, and you're like, okay, now what? How the hell do you go out? How do you get Hulu's interest in it? And like, you know, I'm sure you hit walls everywhere you went because like this has never happened. No one's ever done this. How did you do it?
Yeah, it was a series of unfortunate events followed by one very fortunate event. one single very fortunate event. Well, let's see. We finished. It took us about 8 months to finish the show in post to, you know, get all the episodes to where they needed to be. As we were doing that, we also we got episode two across the finish line, and then we took episode two out to some of these festivals that had accepted us and you know, our pilot episode. We also used episodes one and two to shop really, to take out in a sort of soft way, right? Like to take out to some contacts, or some, you know, inroads that we had made. So we continued that festival circuit. We continued to, take it out a bit, but again, it was the same thing as with, that pilot episode. We still didn't have a sales agent. We were still going through our talent agents to reach development executives. We were still running into walls, and we couldn't get anybody to tell us what to do. You know, there was no, that whole side of the industry is so relationship based. And we didn't have the person with the insight or the relationships, or if we could talk to somebody that did have the relationships, we had something that they didn't know what to do with because there was no template for it. They're like, right. You brought me a movie. If this was a movie, it would be one thing. There's a million ways you could go, but this is a TV show and we don't know what to do with this right now. So we got to, I guess we finished the show sometime in, mid 2019, Steven, something like that, or maybe fall of 2019, we started really getting to a place where we were happy with the show and felt like it was finished. And we're still taking it out. We finally realized that this whole sales thing is probably not going to happen for us. So we start getting ready to self-distribute. We were going to go through Amazon. We were getting our music finished. We were getting all our contracts in line. We were about 2 weeks away from hitting submit to Amazon's platform.
For SVOD and TVOD or just TVOD?
Yeah, for rentals first, I think. To rent it or buy it.
Transactionals first. So, but you knew that. I mean, your budget was, I mean, based on the numbers you're saying, your budget was well north of 250. So to generate that in transactional takes an obscene amount of work and luck and magic from the film gods to make that work. So
we were planning on going, we were taking that as we're going to take the show on the road. Like, there, all right, we're going to do that. Now we also got to go to what was successful for us and go fill some theaters, you know, like, tour around, make some stops and do some appearance kind of stuff just to
leverage
as much interest and bring in some income on that to try to get back our budget.
Yeah, we came up with a pretty good game plan for that. You know, we did the numbers and it seemed like we could get somewhere close based on, you know, we've done fan conventions before for One Tree Hill. We knew that there was a certain amount of a built-in audience for Everyone Is Doing Great itself anyways. You know, we felt good about our odds, really. We knew that it would be really, really tough. We knew that it would be basically like crowdfunding all over again.
Fun. Willing,
yeah, exactly. But we just wanted to get the show out there and we didn't know any other way to do it. And so, yeah, that took us to, I think, about January or February of 2020. And then my brother, who was a producer on the show as well, his name is Stuart. He just made a random phone call to a friend of his who is a producer who has a relationship with Endeavor Content. And so my brother sent this producer our show, our first couple episodes. The producer was like, well, this is interesting. I don't know. By the time he sent it to Endeavor, this agent in Endeavor had taken a look and we were going into lockdown. The lockdown wasn't far away. And this agent went, okay, well, this is, you know, interesting. Like he really, to his credit, like he really saw himself in it in these weird ways. When we finally got on the phone to talk to him, he sort of pitched our show back to us in a way that nobody else really had, which was really cool. He seemed to just connect with it on one level, but then on another level, he was like, you know, we don't know when people are going to be making stuff again. There's going to be a real hole in buyer schedules, you know, come, you know, quarter three, quarter four, and this could be a possibility. So Endeavor Content took it on. And then there was a list of about 17 different buyers that they were going to go out to with the show. And over the course of what, 3 or 4 months, each of those buyers passed really, really painfully.
And slowly and slowly.
And slowly and slowly and painfully. And yeah, we were worn down to the point where we were pretty much just like, going to the park and laying down and staring at the sky, waiting to die.
Right, because there was no tour anymore. The tour was shut down. There's no tour. Yeah, there's none of that stuff. Down. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, and, man.
And then we got the call from Endeavor that said, Hulu wants to make an offer. And that changed literally everything.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Wow. So it was literally the timing, right place, right time, right product.
Yeah.
A year earlier, maybe not so much. A year later, maybe not so much. But that moment in time was the time. And it's similar to my film. Like at that moment in time, it worked. Like they would never buy a film like that today. So it just happened to be the right timing, man. That's, you know what? Like I always say to people, look, luck has a bit to do with this whole thing that we do. There is luck. But the thing is, if you hadn't have built that product, all the luck in the world really wouldn't have helped you. You needed something to sell. So it just happened to work out.
It's kind of like it's a create your own luck scenario, you know? And there's no, you know, everyone's looking for like the recipe, right? How do you do it? So how did you get your independent show to Hulu, right? Tell us the secret. And ultimately, there was a lot of hard work that then fell on chance, you know, and fell on a right place, right time opportunity, which you do hear all the time. And I think that the way you get there at the end of the day is, you know, you pay your dues, you work hard, you're bringing people in too, you're bringing smart people around you, keep you motivated, keep you pushing where, you know, you're overextending yourself. And I think that's what invites the opportunity for maybe that luck to strike, you know. And it's no guarantee, but this is also what we sign up for. Had we tried to do these buyer screenings that didn't work well, had we tried to shake down our reps for months/years to, you know, get it to the right people and never feel like we got the right shot, had we not done all of that, would we have gotten to this moment of right place, right time? You know, I don't think so. It just, you know, there was no shortcuts. You can help your fate. I think I believe.
No, there's no question about it, man. There's absolutely no question. So when is this? So you basically sold Hulu for domestic only. So this still has an international opportunity as well for sales.
We're going to be in Australia, in the Nordics, and in Latin America, courtesy of Paramount Plus and their rollout overseas, which is really, really incredible. And another one of those things, it's like, you know, man, it's crazy because, you know, we didn't get Hulu, then our show is never legitimized enough to get on, you know, Paramount Plus for overseas. You know what I mean? It's like this domino effect of things happening. And, you know, obviously it shows the power of getting onto, a streamer like that. But, we're just really grateful that we're going to get a reaction from other cultures as well, because, you know, we seem to have gotten a really good feedback from our domestic audience. Mm-hmm. People are still finding the show. Most people seem to like it. But, you know, comedy's hard when you export it. Mm-hmm. Different cultures find different things funny. We were actually really inspired by some Australian comedy and Australian storytelling in general, British storytelling. So we feel like it will export nicely there, we hope. But we know non-English speaking countries, it's really impossible for us to tell. And so, yeah, we're kind of waiting on pins and needles to see how it does. And it's going to be really exciting. We got a call from Endeavor actually asking if we wanted to, have a say in, the voices for, the Latin American market and the Portuguese market for dubbing. And we both were like, I think we could be hands off with this.
Yeah.
This is one we're comfortable delegating.
It's just like, estoy aquí, por favor.
I got to brush up on my Portuguese before I, you know.
No, dude, I used to do versioning out for commercials for Latin America. I had to do 30 different versions because every country has their own Spanish. So you can't send a Puerto Rican VO guy to Mexico. You can't send a Mexican guy to Argentina. There's such a difference in accents. And that's when I discovered that you just can't, it's not one Spanish. You can't send a Spaniard down to Mexico. Like it doesn't translate well. It doesn't get accepted well. So that's going to be a process for you guys down there. Whoever's doing that, which you guys hands off of that, it's going to be an interesting.
You're making me very glad that we said
no. Stay away from it, stay out of that, dude. Just collect the check, sir. Just take the check and cash it. That's great, man. Listen, this is an inspiring story. I know that there's a lot of actors out there who have maybe been on shows or has a following and are frustrated, just like you guys were, with having to go and hustle out jobs and asking for permission constantly. And I'm not saying you're still not doing that, obviously, because I'm not the agents, would get very upset. So so you're still going out on jobs and stuff, but at least you have a little bit more control of your own destiny, where you're like, we have a track record now we can go out and do maybe a movie or another series, and maybe get hired to be on that side of the fence. And now you're building a different level of your career. What advice would you give any actors listening out there right now? Because I know I have a few actors who listen as well, about trying to do something similar to what you guys are doing.
Yeah, I think one thing that was easy to forget the more serious the process got for us was that we started this thing as an experiment, a creative experiment. And we agreed with each other that, if that pilot episode sucked, then nobody would ever see it, and that would be okay. We only spent as much money as we were comfortable losing on that pilot. And we went at it experimentally. And I think that gave us the freedom to be creative as we could possibly be, to be uninhibited and being creative. And it really helped us to just enjoy the process. And that was extremely important in finding the tone of this thing and determining what it really was, in shooting it, and also, in getting in there in the edit, and making sure that we just had the time, and we were giving ourselves the luxury of time to learn and taking the pressure off, right, as much as humanly possible, at least with that first episode. And I would say that's the advice that I would give to an actor that's going to go out and make their first movie, is like, look, you won't get this right the very first time. You might get it right, but you won't get it as right as you could, because you will be learning every step of the way. And that's okay. That doesn't actually mean that it won't be brilliant. Like, it could be incredible, but you're going to see the mistakes in it. The finished product, you will see the mistakes in it. So don't worry about getting it exactly right all the way through. Worry about setting out to tell the story that you want to tell, and by the end of it, hopefully you will have told it. I think, know the story that you want to tell, and also make the kind of thing that you would want to watch. And, mm-hmm. That's all you got to worry about the first time around. Surround yourself with people that can worry about the other stuff for you, and treat them with respect and pay them well if you can. But at the end of the day, just try to make the show or the movie that you would want to watch, and see what happens. And if you make mistakes, that's okay. You will learn from those mistakes, mm-hmm. and you'll get it right the next time.
How about you, Steven?
Yeah, I would say, check your ego at the door from the jump. It's not you're not the star of the show here. I think anybody who can come on and work for hopefully a decent meal and that Starbucks coffee after lunch is now the star for you. Getting those people around you that are going to be able to, help push you with this project, help get it to its finish line, and have it, be quality in a way. I think that creating those relationships and supporting them wherever they need support is very vital. So, this isn't about just work on your project here. You offer your ass up to carry gear for them on another project or whatever it is, I do that and get that experience and create those relationships, because this is not something, we're not Steven Soderbergh over here. You're not going to be able to do everything on your own. You need a lot of help. And so, people are going to work with people that they, believe in and that they enjoy working with, especially when the going gets tough,
Have a really good script supervisor. If you're going to be in front of and behind the camera, get your ass a really good script supervisor.
A good first AD doesn't hurt either.
Exactly. Yeah.
Definitely doesn't hurt either. I'm going to ask you a couple questions I ask all my guests. What is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
Get off your butt and do it. That was the one that took me the longest to learn. Definitely.
Really?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, as an actor, you are very single-minded when you get to set. And that's the way it should be. Like, you are there to take care of your job, and be present for the other people that are in the scene with you. I worked as a director in television as well, which was incredible, which was one of the most like animating and eye-opening things that ever happened to me, because that's where I realized just how much of an ecosystem every single set is, right? And how much every little component depends on the next one. That was a big eye opener for me. And it was a whole other level of working hard. And it was something that I enjoyed, but still you have that safety net. Still, there is a machine working to help you get everything done. You are not pulling the thing along. You are more of a facilitator, right? But yeah, it wasn't until, you know, working with the Nelms brothers and Michelle Lang and Johnny Durango on their sets, that's when I realized the power and the gratification that can come from just getting off your butt and doing something, yourself, pulling something yourself together yourself, how much you can learn, how good you can get at what you want to do. You know, if you want to tell stories, the best way to, if you want to tell stories this way, I think the best way to become a master at it is to try to pull something together yourself. That's what they taught me. Mm-hmm. And it took me a while to learn that. I didn't meet them until I was like 25. So
how about you, Steve?
Oh man. There's a few things I figure out I'm still getting. It's funny, like I do believe that it's tricky that like once like staying in your own lane is an important thing to know like what you can't do, but at the same time with this spirit of this project, it was like try to do as and figure out as much as possible. But I think that there was I still need to understand like knowing my boundaries, and once I know what, when I know what those are, like just don't try to pretend like you know anything else, you know, or no further trying to take on something that you're like, oh, well, I'll just figure it out. I think it's okay to seek out help or admit that you just don't know how to do something. You know, I think sometimes we're fearful of, you know, feeling, inept at whatever, you know, at being able to finish a job. And so, you know, you try to overextend yourself or you try to say you got it, but, and ultimately don't, and now you've set things back. So I think it's understanding, you know, my boundaries, and I feel like I'm still trying to figure that out. You know, like, you know, I can't say that I can do this when I can't, or, you know, there's not everything I can figure out on my own.
Right.
So,
yeah. And the toughest question of all, three of your favorite films of all time.
Oh gosh.
Well, Alex, I listened to your podcast and prepared myself for this because I never had the answers for this.
You son of a bitch. Thanks for the heads up, dude.
I planned it this way. I got to go with E.T.
Okay.
Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Nice.
And Silver Linings Playbook.
Nice.
Because I feel like I learned something from each one of those films at the time in my life that I watched it. So it was like, you know, when I was a tadpole, and then when I was like, you know, pubescent, and then as an adult. So right. There was something for me in each one of those stages.
So
oh, you God, just... beat that, Steven.
Wow. Well, he just left you dangling in the wind there, brother. I'm sorry about that.
Well, I'm just going to say, we had like three VHS tapes in my house growing up. And one was like somebody had left a Blockbuster video, which was Predator, over at our house.
Obviously one of the greatest action films of all time.
And Forrest Gump, which I thought like the scope of that movie was always something that just like stuck in my mind. And the way, yeah, the way the story's told, the way we go throughout all these different parts of history, and, mm-hmm. and that sat with me. I think of late, well, actually not of late, but it was actually James' little brother introduced me to True Romance, directed by Tony Scott, and so that is good. That is a favorite of mine.
Dude, I remember walking out, because I'm a bit older than you guys, so I remember walking out of the theater watching True Romance, and me and my friends just looked at each other like, what the hell was that? Like, we were just in shock.
That's another movie that – another feeling that I had. There, I'll give you two other movies that, for me, going to the movies, with like the experience is about. Paranormal Activity. When that movie ended, like just the reaction in the theater was amazing. Mm-hmm. And then also Interstellar was another one, which was amazing, going into the bathroom afterwards and just getting everyone's reaction. You're just like, oh, wow. Like that was like – it's like when it's kind of almost hard to step back in society, you know, you're like walk out. And it's not just the glare of being back in the sunlight. It's like, whoa, like where did I just go?
God, I miss that. I miss going to the theaters, man. I miss going and getting that experience. I just saw a picture of Nolan in Burbank.
Oh yeah,
going to that's the theater I go to. That's exactly exact theater I go to. And he's just sitting there with his wife and his friend, just like we're gonna watch. I think he was watching the Snyder Cut there. I'm not sure what he was watching, but he was watching something there.
That's what I was honestly trying to Google that as well.
I think he was watching Justice League, the 4-hour cut of that at the theater. It's, yeah, man, Nolan is, I mean, Jesus, there's only one of him running around right now in the world. That's for sure. Listen, guys, thank you so much for being on the show and being an inspiration to a lot of people out there, hopefully listening, and maybe they'll pick up their chariot to take it to the finish line and try to get something done. So I appreciate that, man. And good luck to you guys. Keep going. I can't wait to see what else you guys do next.
Thanks so much, man. Yeah, I appreciate your podcast too. Great work.
Thank you, man. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, man. Keep hustling.
I want to thank James and Steven for coming on the show and dropping their knowledge bombs on the tribe. And also for the inspiration for a lot of filmmakers out there who are trying to get series off the ground or series sold to major streamers. So thank you so much, guys. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/466. And if you haven't already, head over to filmmakingpodcast.com and leave a good review for the show. It really helps us out a lot. Thank you again so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at indiefilmhustle.com. That's INDIEFILMHUSTLE.com.